The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. This weekend, writers and book lovers mourn the passing of celebrated author Harper Lee. Written 56 years ago, Lee's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, is an American classic and continues to give a glimpse into what life was like in the Deep South back in the 1930s.
Macon was a tired old town, even in 1932 when I first knew it. There was no hurry, for there was nowhere to go, nothing to buy, no money to buy it with. Although Macon County had recently been told that it had nothing to fear but fear itself. That summer, I was 6 years old.
That's from the 1962 film adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. While the novel went on to sell 40 million copies, Monroeville, Alabama, the town that Macon was based on, quietly faded from the public imagination. Writer Paul Theroux went down to Monroeville to see the town where Harper Lee and her childhood friend Truman Capote grew up, and which now calls itself the literary capital of Alabama. He wrote about his visit for Smithsonian Magazine and spoke to Virginia about it right before the publication of Lee's second novel, Go Set a Watchman.
Well, for many people, To Kill a Mockingbird really forms one of the few images they have of a small town in the Deep South. Is the Macon of To Kill a Mockingbird similar to the Monroeville you visited this year?
I think there's a sort of glow about the Macon of the book. Monroeville is like a lot of towns in the South. They're places that were once industrious. They had business, they had manufacturing, they had cotton or some kind of agriculture, and they've lost it, either because of NAFTA or just people leaving. So Monroeville, the Macon of the novel, is rather sad, out of work, and it's sort of a shadow of its former self. You know, after this terrible crime in the book, as it's described, set in the 1930s, there were several other crimes there, you know, racial crimes, which were just as bad. So the book didn't enlighten anyone or cure anyone of their bigotry or the injustice that was going on there.
Well, the town is trying to capitalize on its relationship to the book and the movie and as home to Truman Capote and to Harper Lee, who still does live there. Well, first, what did you learn about these two famous residents from townsfolk who remembered them?
What you find, it's very interesting. This is also true of the South in general, which is that writers in the South tend to make a reputation by leaving the South. There are a couple of exceptions. Flannery O'Connor is an exception. William Faulkner is an exception. There are a few others. But most Southern writers became famous or established themselves as writers by leaving. And when Harper Lee, or Nell they call her down there, she went to New York City. She wanted to write a novel. She's had a very odd career. Truman Capote the same. They grew up as neighbors. Harper Lee was Truman Capote's defender. He was kind of a whale, wimpy thing, and she was pretty tough. But the town is very proud of them, but the town didn't nurture them, and any more than, you know, other towns in the South nurtured their writers. They come to New York, they go to Boston, go to New Hampshire, for that matter, and the Southern writer makes a reputation. Barry Hannah, who's a Southern writer from Mississippi, said that he got most of his writing done by living in Vermont in the snow. So the fact that the book is set there and Go Set a Watchman is set in Monroeville means that people go there on literary pilgrimages and they look for the remnants of the town. And actually, because the town is so poor, the remnants of the town still exist. There's still the courthouse, still the stores, there's still the old, you know, hardware store, the old jail, the black part of town, the wealthy white part of town, the golf course, and 24 churches, you know, literally 24 churches that are all bustling and busy on Sunday. So no one's disappointed when they go to Monroeville. They see it and they say, this is just what I was expecting to find.
But yet some of the residents that you spoke to kind of rolled their eyes when the novel was mentioned. Why?
Black residents roll their eyes because they say very little has changed. White residents don't roll their eyes. They're kind of pleased and proud. Black residents have had a tough time there. They're still somewhat sidelined, and their story hasn't been told. And certainly, Harper Lee didn't tell their story. After she wrote that book, she didn't write anything else. Hers is one of the oddest literary careers in the books. So she wrote the book. She's got those two books, the old one that's coming out now, and To Kill a Mockingbird. And then she just, you know, she was only in her 30s, and she just stopped. She was making a ton of money, but, I mean, she didn't do what I was doing, which is, you know, go to a place and write about it and write for a magazine. And I've written, you know, with no boast, but I've written about 50 books in my life. So she hasn't done that. Nothing against her. It's just something I don't understand and would like to understand. But no one can ask her. No one talks to her. She doesn't give interviews. So we'll never know the reason.
Well, the book, of course, was set in the 1930s in the Jim Crow South. You met a number of people who remembered living there at that time. And you just alluded to that's not officially segregated today, but there are some pretty distinct color lines for the people of Monroeville. Where do those begin and end?
People have long memories there, and there's memories of where people live and where they don't live. Actually, the color line isn't strict in Monroe. You know, the traditionally white part of town has plenty of black residents. The black part of town doesn't have any white residents. Where you find segregation in the South is in churches, barbershops, and funeral parlors. You never find a white person in a black funeral parlor or a white person in a black barbershop or vice versa. But it's not so much the segregation because people tend to self-segregate. The odd thing was how little had changed in terms of justice. In the 1980s, there was a miscarriage of justice that was just like To Kill a Mockingbird, where a man who was completely innocent, black man, was found guilty of killing a white woman, and he was put on death row. And he was gone off on an innocence project. There was no evidence to support it. But this was in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the book by then had been a long bestseller, and people thought, oh, well, everything's fine. But one of the curious things about the South is that things aren't fine, and I think you notice that, this controversy about the Confederate flag.
Right.
If you go to Selma, for example, Selma is a wonderful example of voters' rights and the will of people. But if you go to Selma today, you'll see a place that really there's no work. It's very sad. Businesses are closed, and it's a symbol of something, but there's not a lot happening. The South may not rise again, but the South is a very sad and bewildered place.
We're talking with the writer and novelist Paul Theroux about his visit to Monroeville, Alabama. That's the town fictionalized as Macomb in Harper Lee's famous novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, and the new novel, Go Set a Watchman, which is coming out tomorrow. Well, you make the point that the kind of dramatic weirdness that has traditionally been played up in the Southern fiction of Faulkner or Flannery O'Connor or Erskine Caldwell, and even today's fiction, looks backwards rather than the aspects of contemporary Southern life. Well, what's going on there?
I think that what it is, it's sort of indirection. It's people satirizing themselves by exaggerating the freakishness of their society and not looking at the ordinary facts of the society, the realities of it. The realities are really almost too sad to contemplate. So it's made into a kind of carnival, kind of freak show, a sort of circus, and with grotesque characters. And that's the way Southern fiction has sort of managed. And this is also why, if you go from New Hampshire to Mississippi, you'll find something that you hadn't expected to find. The Mississippi and Alabama that's described in the books doesn't exist. You go there and you'd find a completely different place, a more interesting place, a sadder place, but a less highly colored place. Mainly, you find places that are out of work. There's no work. And when people don't have any work, when they have no money, when they're entirely dependent on government handouts, welfare, or living, you know, poorly, they're living a completely different kind of life. It's not colorful. It's just rather sad.
But even under this long shadow of racial injustice and places that you're describing as being completely left behind economically, the Deep South, it's still a draw for those nostalgic for, you know, the sleepy Southern towns where the humidity is thick and the tea is sweet. Are these the sort of paradoxes maybe unique to the South?
Yes, I haven't. I feel as if I've been negative talking to you. The South has so many virtues. People really are friendly, black and white, very friendly. Friendly to strangers, friendly to each other. There's no question about that. They have a sense of the past. They have a strong sense of their history. They have a lot of pride in their culture, in their cooking, in the way of speaking. So much has been taken from them, and they feel very belittled and mocked. They feel they've lost everything. They lost the Civil War. The Civil Rights Movement was a kind of war. People are trying to take things away from them. Now, you know, rightly or wrongly, they want to take guns away. They want to take the flag away. They want to take, you know, the memory of their struggle away. So I'm not saying that they are right, but you can kind of identify with their sense of feeling weakened by outside forces, mm-hmm. just the way they did through history. But the federal government, Washington's trying to tell them what to do. And it's not that they all want to be slave owners. They want their identity. And I'm speaking of both of blacks and whites, that the Southern identity really cuts across that.
Well, one of the many characters that you write about and meet in your trip, Sam Williams, he was once a traveling lingerie salesman, and he urged you, talk nice about Monroeville. What would he think of your portrait of that town?
I was so struck by this man. I was asking him questions about the past, about the trial, about the book. His business had closed. This man was a traveling salesman for a lingerie manufacturer that at its peak hired or employed 2,500 people in Monroeville. Uh-huh. Now it's gone, and those 2,500 people are unemployed. Mm. Then he became conscious of the fact that he was being kind of downbeat, and then he said to me, when you leave, talk nice about us. Don't run us down. And I don't want to run them down. I don't think that they did it to themselves. The South in general lost its industry because of companies leaving. They went to Mexico, they went to China, they went to India, they went to Vietnam. They left them, and they left the people unemployed. You know, agriculture became mechanized. So there's mass unemployment, and that's not a great thing. It's really hurt the South, and they feel damaged as a result.
How about this new book, Go Set a Watchman? Are you looking forward to reading it?
I'm looking forward to reading it, but I don't have high hopes. You may have gathered from what I wrote in Smithsonian that I'm not a great fan of To Kill a Mockingbird. I think that Flannery O'Connor is right. It's a child's book. It's an oversimple book. And the writing is very odd. It reads very much like an early effort at writing. If you write for a long time, over a period of time, I mean, I'm way past retirement age. I've written, you know, every day of my life I write something. Your writing does change and it improves. But Harper Lee's writing is frozen in time, and her views are frozen in time. So I don't have high hopes, but as an artifact, as a piece of history, I'm very, very curious to read it.
Well, Paul Theroux, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Virginia. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
That's travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux speaking with Virginia Prescott about his visit to Monroeville, Alabama, the town fictionalized as Maycomb in Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Outcasts like Boo Radley have been scapegoats for all manner of strange happenings, and not just in fiction. When we return, the story of an Illinois town which was home to one of the most bizarre cases of mass hysteria in America. That's after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. In the 1940s, someone, or something, was prowling around Mattoon, Illinois, spraying knockout gas into residents' homes in the middle of the night. The mad gasser of Mattoon terrified the town. The problem was, he didn't exist. Memory Palace producer Nate DeMeo has the incredible story of one of the most peculiar cases of mass hysteria in U.S. history.
The man awoke with a start and threw up. He could barely see. It was just before dawn. He smelled something strange and sweet in the air there in his bedroom. He turned to his wife and asked her to run to the kitchen and make sure that the pilot light in the stove was still on, that there wasn't a gas leak. She went to get up, but found that her legs no longer worked. Later that night, on August 31st, 1944, a young woman across town, her husband off to war, awoke alone in her bed to the sound of her daughter crying and coughing in the next room. She went to get up, but found that her legs no longer worked. The next night, around 11:30, a woman, Mrs. Kearney, was getting ready for bed. She smelled something strange. She walked around her dark house trying to find the source, until her legs started tingling, and she found they no longer worked. She screamed, you would too, and her sister came running in from down the hall. She called the police. When they came, she told them that the strange smell seemed to be coming in through her sister's bedroom window. The police didn't find anything. They left, and left the woman alone. 2 hours later, Mrs. Kearney's husband, Bert, pulled into the driveway after his shift as a taxi driver. There, beneath his bedroom window, while his wife slept just inside, was a strange figure dressed in black, crouching in the darkness. Bert would later tell the police that the figure, tall and thin, ran off into the woods and vanished. The good people of Mattoon, Illinois, were terrified. Over the course of several nights, 21 of them were awoken, those who were able to sleep at all, with the smell of gas coming through the window, or to find that they were unable to move, or to find the strange man in black standing, looking at them through their windows, before disappearing into the night. The police would come, and there'd be nothing, no footprints, nothing at all. But still, the strange man in black kept coming. The police added officers to the late shift. The FBI was brought in from Springfield. Citizen patrols took to the streets with flashlights and guns, trying to catch the strange man in black. But they didn't, and he kept coming, terrorizing people in the night. A few times he left little clues, a torn screen, some trampled brush. Beulah Cordes of North 21st Street came home late one night to find a white piece of cloth on her porch. She's picked it up and smelled it, and doubled over, vomiting and screaming that her mouth and her throat were burning. When the cops arrived and ran tests on the cloth, they determined that whatever caused Mrs. Cordes to become sick had vanished from the cloth, like the strange man in the night. And then it was over. The strange man in black was gone, as mysteriously as he had arrived. And when he was gone, some people said he wasn't a man at all, that he was something other, something from beyond this world. Even today, the people of Mattoon say that sometimes in early fall, as they lie awake in the dark, they can hear him tapping at their windows. Nah, they don't. Although, having been to Mattoon, it might give them something to do. I think they don't, anyway. I haven't done, like, a poll or anything, but they shouldn't. Because the man in black, the man the papers called the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, or the Anesthetic Prowler, or my favorite, the Phantom Anesthetist, probably didn't exist. And I don't mean that in a ghosts-don't-exist sort of way. I mean, there probably wasn't even a creepy weirdo running around town, or a guy with a spray can trying to knock people out to break in and steal their stuff. The strange smell, the vomiting, the burning lips and throats may have been caused by some pre-EPA, pre-Clean Air Act emissions from a couple of industrial plants nearby. That's what the chief of police declared shortly after the frantic call stopped coming into his station. But eventually, opinion coalesced around another theory. The Mad Gasser of Mattoon was a case of mass hysteria. Those first attacks were all in the victims' heads. And then the idea of the attacks got into everyone's heads. A psychologist first put the theory forward a few years later in the early 50s. And though his reason for it, that the women were hysterical because their men were off fighting World War II, sort of icky and sexist, his mass hysteria theory has held up. Meaning the good people of Mattoon, Illinois, in late summer, early fall, 1944, joined the people of Strasbourg, Germany, who danced uncontrollably for days on end in 1518. The nuns who couldn't stop screaming and squirming at a convent in Würzburg, Germany in 1749. the other nuns who would meow for several hours a day in Austria later that century. The students at a mission school near Lake Tanganyika who started laughing one afternoon in 1963 and couldn't stop, and then their laughter spread throughout the surrounding villages. Or the 600 girls at an all-girls school in Mexico who in 2006 became paralyzed and nauseous. Just like the people of Mattoon, after the strange man in black came in the night. The strange man in black who didn't exist at all. Or did he? Nah, I'm just screwing with you, he totally didn't.
That was producer Nate DeMeo, creator of the podcast The Memory Palace.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott.
There was always a baron of beef, or a shoulder or leg of lamb before my father.
That's an opening scene from the film How Green Was My Valley, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1941. That same year, another little film was snubbed from the red carpet.
Rosebud.
Enraged by his likeness to the title character, newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst reportedly did everything in his power to destroy Citizen Kane. And although he couldn't prevent its release, he was able to squash its success at the box office and ruin its chances for Best Picture. Hearst's attack was the first and perhaps most aggressive smear campaign in the Academy's history. But there have been plenty more since. Virginia spoke to Marlo Stern, entertainment editor at the Daily Beast, about it, and started the conversation by asking about a little-known smear campaign against Good Will Hunting.
Right. So this was a Harvey Weinstein film, so he wasn't behind it. But the smear was that William Goldman, writer of All the President's Men, had written it, but then he later confessed that he didn't. And then after that, Variety ran a story insinuating that Ted Talley, writer of Silence of the Lambs, wrote the screenplay, which, again, turned out to be a completely ridiculous claim. And I think just a lot of people had a hard time wrapping their head around the fact that these two boys from Boston, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, with dimples, could churn out such a good screenplay.
Well, and I say that they get remembered because we were sitting around when we were talking about this thinking, wait, did they actually write this? You know, so these kind of things carry over. In general, who orchestrates them, the studios or competing nominees?
It's a mixture of both, but I think it's usually the competing nominees. I mean, Matt Damon later told the New York Times that the Ted Talley stuff all came from the, quote, As Good As It Gets camp, which was the other nominee that year for Best Original Screenplay, was James Brooks. But obviously, he said the filmmaker had nothing to do with that. It was these, perhaps the publicists that the film had hired for their Oscar campaign.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
Well, the year after that, 1999, another smear against Saving Private Ryan. What happened?
Right. In 1999, the two big Best Picture contenders were Saving Private Ryan, Steven Spielberg's big World War II epic, and Shakespeare in Love, which was a comparatively smaller film. And the first thing that happened was that Harvey Weinstein spent an enormous amount of money promoting Shakespeare in Love during Oscar season, something like $5 to $10 million on the Oscar campaign, which was unheard of at the time. It was usually studios, especially small studios like Miramax, would only spend around $1 million for their Oscar campaign. But he spent $5 to $10 million and really raised the bar as far as Oscar spending goes for ads. But the thing that really probably hurt Saving Private Ryan's chances the most were all these stories that came out in the press that said that the British were, quote, riled by Ryan, and that a group of British World War II veterans felt slighted by Spielberg's film because during the Omaha Beach sequence, which is the most riveting scene in the film, the C Company of the U.S. Rangers 2nd Battalion is seen being dispatched by U.S. ships when in actuality the British Royal Navy dispatched them to Omaha Beach. So a bunch of stories started surfacing in the press saying that surviving British members of the Royal Navy were pissed off that they weren't included in the film.
Well, the Weinstein brothers come up again. Shakespeare in Love did take the Oscar for Best Picture back in 1999. They obviously didn't invent the dirty politics, but how much gets tied back to them?
You know, they definitely changed the game a little bit. And I'm not sure exactly how much they're responsible for, but they've done things that are interesting, to say the least. I mean, during the year that Gangs of New York was up for a bunch of Oscars, including Best Picture, and it was really Martin Scorsese's comeback, they even took out ads that said that Robert Wise, the director of Sound of Music, praised Gangs of New York and said it should win Best Picture, when it came out that not only had Robert Wise not penned this open letter praising Gangs of New York, it was penned by a Miramax publicist, and Robert Wise just signed it. And so the Academy had to develop new rules. So now you can't really get former Academy members to publicly endorse nominees.
Well, how about put down a film? Because in 2006, it was a couple of esteemed actors that helped scupper the chances for Brokeback Mountain. Tell us the story behind that.
This is one of the more bizarre smear campaigns waged during Oscar season. In 2006, it was Crash, Paul Haggis's racial relations drama, versus Ang Lee's Brokeback Mountain, this beautiful cowboy love story. Two veteran actors, Tony Curtis and Ernest Borgnine, took it upon themselves to violently campaign against Brokeback Mountain. Out of nowhere, it seems. They didn't even see the movie. They appeared on Fox News saying some homophobic remarks. And it was most surprising coming from Tony Curtis, because he had starred in Some Like It Hot, which is, you know, one of the biggest...
cross-dressing comedies?
Quote-unquote gay films. Yeah, cross-dressing comedies of all time. And it ended up hurting Brokeback Mountain, and it lost to Crash for Best Picture. The other thing that happened, though, was that the producers of Crash also sent out 130,000 Oscar screeners to virtually every member of the Screen Actors Guild and the Academy,
wow,
which was also unprecedented that year. So it could have been a combination of the smear campaign and also the crazy PR push by the people behind Crash.
Tell you what, we could have had a good life together, had us a place of our own. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain.
Well, we have two interesting, almost side-by-side examples of The Hurt Locker in 2010, Kathryn Bigelow's film, when she was up against her ex-husband, James Cameron, who produced the multi-million dollar film Avatar. And then just a couple of years later, her film Zero Dark Thirty about the bin Laden raid. If you could just tell us a little bit about the politics or the inner politicking of those campaigns, how they played out differently, and why you think they did.
Sure. They both involved Kathryn Bigelow films, but they were very different smear campaigns. I mean, the first example, 2010's The Hurt Locker, when it was up for Best Picture versus Avatar, which obviously made close to $3 billion, whereas The Hurt Locker had only grossed, you know, less than $50 million worldwide, and I think under $20 million in the U.S., becoming, I believe, the lowest grossing Best Picture winner ever, although you also check my fact work on that. But all these stories seem to come out around the time of The Hurt Locker, of ex-bomb disposal experts questioning its authenticity, claiming that it didn't depict combat accurately, and also the producer of The Hurt Locker, or one of the producers on The Hurt Locker, Nicholas Chartier, came out and wrote this mass email to all his friends and fellow Oscar voters asking him to vote for his film over a, quote, $500 million film, saying that, you know, voting for Hill's film would be beneficial to the independent film industry, while if you vote for Avatar, you're basically just patting Hollywood on the back. So all these things started to come out around the release of Hurt Locker. Thankfully, The Hurt Locker wasn't affected by it and went on to win 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Kathryn Bigelow, making her the first woman ever to win the award. Now, the case of Zero Dark Thirty is a little different. I mean, with Zero Dark Thirty, from the word go, it was under attack by every op-ed writer, it seemed, saying that it promoted torture. Frank Bruni, the New York Times columnist, penned this crazy op-ed with the opening line, "I'm betting that Dick Cheney will love the new movie Zero Dark Thirty."
Mm-hmm.
And Bigelow and screenwriter and her partner at the time, Mark Bull, who was an ex-journalist himself, claimed the contrary and, you know, wrote their own op-eds and came out in defense of the film. But still, it caused a lot of controversy. And the film, even though it had, you know, it was the most critically acclaimed film of the year, it had the highest Metacritic score of any film that year, it only managed to win one Oscar for Best Sound Editing when all was said and done.
Well, I guess that's a question. The New York Times seems to have been behind it in that case. Do smear campaigns get set in motion by a motivated party? Or do you think maybe the attention that nominees get just attracts a greater scrutiny?
You know, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, on the one hand, films do hire these specialty awards publicists during award season that may have a hand in concocting a lot of these campaigns. And on the other hand, I think the media plays off it as well because it's interesting, enticing copy, and people enjoy reading about scandals. So they are, while they are mostly manufactured scandals, they prove enticing to the public.
That's Marlo Stern, entertainment editor at The Daily Beast, talking with Virginia Prescott about the history of Oscar smear campaigns. And we move from the dark side of Hollywood to some of its most memorable and beautiful bits, the precise art of title sequences. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. From Woody Allen's consistent use of Windsor font to Hitchcock's partnership with designer Saul Bass, the title sequences of certain films capture our imaginations and burn into our memories. Roman Mars of 99% Invisible brings us the story of the careful art of title sequences.
If I was a flower growing wild and free, all I'd want is you to be my sweet honeybee. And if I was a tree growing tall and green, all I'd want is you to shade me and be my leaves.
So the teenage girl named Juno is walking down the street with a half-empty one-gallon jug of Sunny D citrus beverage in one hand. She passes a tree and everything becomes animated. It's kind of a lo-fi, unpolished Xerox copy animation inspired by punk rock music flyers.
So how long did you have that main title music from Juno stuck in your head?
It's still there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You know what? They're using it on some commercial these days. And when I heard it, I just got flashbacks. It was crazy.
If I was a flower growing wild and free, all I'd want is you to be my sweet honeybee. And if I was a tree growing tall and green, all I'd want is you to shade me and be my leaves.
The title sequence immediately establishes Juno's quirky worldview.
You cut your title sequences to music, so you must live with these songs for months at a time, right?
Yes. As a title designer, it's very important that the music that you use in a sequence is something that you love, that you really enjoy working with, because it can be rough otherwise. My name is Gareth Smith, and I am a film title designer.
Gareth and his partner Jenny Lee did the titles for Juno and Up in the Air, among others.
My name is Ian Albinson, and I am the founder and editor-in-chief of Art of the Title, a website that curates title design.
Ian's site is awesome.
It's a completely different set of people that do the work.
That do title sequences.
People don't always realize that. And I always seem to be always surprised that, oh, someone actually thought about this and someone actually gets paid to design and to work on something so separate from the film, yet so connected to the film.
Fundamentally, a title sequence is a presentation of a legal document to the audience.
It's a list of names of the crew and actors and everything who are associated with a film.
And then there's the more interesting and artistic reason for the title sequence,
which is establishing tone and perhaps a storyline.
But there are rules.
When you're doing a studio film, the designer or the company will get a document that's, you know, maybe 10 to 15 pages long.
If you just wrote out the text for the title sequence, it could fit easily on a single page, but
of course, it's this 15-page document. And beside each title, there's several paragraphs of text about how each title needs to be treated.
Like maybe in some sequences, the lead two actors require their names to be bigger than the other titles.
And they'll actually list in the document the exact percentage size that it needs to be bigger than the other titles in the sequence. So it's very specific, and as a designer, it gets very frustrating and challenging to deal with this because it feels very limiting to need to have every single title in the sequence be exactly the same size.
When it comes to innovation and influence in title design, there are two words you need to know. Saul Bass.
He was a major benchmark in terms of realizing that you could have good design in a title sequence. When Saul Bass came along. He was a designer that started to work on more promotion for films and then started to bring his illustration and design style to films. He worked with Hitchcock on a number of pieces.
If the title sequences of Saul Bass don't immediately spring to mind, do yourself a favor and Google Anatomy of Murder or Man with the Golden Arm or Psycho or Vertigo. So good.
What I love about some of his earlier title sequences is if you look at them, they're basically animated film posters.
But a lot of that Saul Bass style faded away in the 80s.
You know, the 80s and the 90s, you started to get the branding idea with films. And so a lot of title sequences weren't so much title sequences, but were just sort of the logo of the film. And so you're creating the brand for the film. So you have Back to the Future, where it's a very iconic logo design. And you have a lot of that in late 80s and early 90s. You didn't see as many complete opening sequences or title sequences, be them standalone or sort of integrated with the film.
Which is not done very much these days. I don't know if you've noticed that, but there are not a lot of films where there's just a big logo that you see on the poster, you know?
But then we hit the second major benchmark, the movie Seven. Its titles were created by Kyle Cooper.
He sort of reintroduced the idea that the title sequence could be its own thing, which is what Bass did, you know, decades earlier.
The title sequence of Seven works as both a standalone vignette and as a vital introduction to the grimy and obsessive feel of the movie. The serial killer in Seven doesn't appear until two-thirds of the way into the film, but you really get to know the killer right here in the first 2 minutes. Kyle Cooper took us inside his head.
The most memorable title sequences are really ones where, you know, there's a great movie after it. If Seven was put in front of some, you know, terrible movie that no one saw, it wouldn't have moved on to influence a generation of title designers after it.
One of Ian Albinson's favorite title sequences is another Kyle Cooper creation, The Island of Dr. Moreau. It was the one that kicked Ian in the head and made him start noticing titles in the first place. But if you were smart, you probably didn't see The Island of Dr. Moreau, and you don't know how cool the title sequence is. But every human on Earth over the age of 20 knows the name of Gareth Smith's favorite title sequence. Making your way
in the world. The TV title sequence for Cheers. I can watch that endlessly. I remember liking it before I was a designer or had anything to do with design, so I was trying to put my finger on why I like it. And of course, a great theme song on that title sequence makes a big difference, but it also just has lovely typography, very simple, lovely typography, and the editing of the sequence is fantastic. It just captures the entire tone of the television show in 30 seconds to a minute.
Cheers is a montage of historical drawings and photographs of people enjoying themselves in bars.
And what they do underneath each of the title cards for the actors is they actually find a historical image that does sort of suggest that character in the television series. The reason I enjoy it is warmth and friendship. And that really comes across, I think, in that title sequence. There are a lot of fans of film title design out there. I was trying to figure out why that is, and I feel like film title design more than other sorts of design has a bit of a longevity because it is committed to film. Because, you know, a lot of design is commercial or print, and it kind of is designed to exist for a week or 2 weeks and then just vanish from the face of the planet. Whereas film design, you really do have to think about, what is this going to look like in 25 years? You hope that the movie you're working on is going to be one of those movies that's going to be seen many years from now, you know? And it has to kind of hold up over time.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars and the podcast 99% Invisible. If you'd like to see some of the glorious title sequences, we've collected them on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, while we may fawn over the title design of Vertigo or the artistic brilliance of the opening sequence of Mad Men and Game of Thrones, opens are also important for radio programs. Case in point, our open.
Word of mouth.
That took probably a few days to make. We had to collect all different pieces of tape of people saying word of mouth. And actually, public radio fans might recognize Kurt Anderson from Studio 360 as one of the people saying Word of mouth.
Oh, that's nice. Taylor Quimby, senior producer. So you worked on that open.
I did. One of our old senior producers gathered all the tape, and then I sort of made some of the effects and like the echo and that sort of thing.
Oh, nice. Maureen, executive producer of our show. Do you have a specific open from a radio program that's your favorite?
Well, I have a favorite, and it also is one that will be very familiar to our audience, and one that I would say is quite groundbreaking. So let's listen to it first.
Oh, wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Right. You're listening to Radio Lab.
Radio Lab.
From
WNYC.
And NPR.
The only difference now is that Radio Lab is now carried by WNYC, so they no longer have the NPR, but everyone loves the NPR. So I decided to go old school. The Radio Lab open is really important, I think, to public radio. In general, because I think when it first came out, it was really groundbreaking. I think we're all really used to hearing it now, but I remember, I think it was back in maybe 2004 or 2005 when Radiolab started airing on WNYC in New York, and people, as a radio producer, it just completely blew my mind. It was the first time that I heard a radio open that was that experimental. So I think that Radiolab really changed the game in terms of using the open of a radio show, not just to say, identify the host, identify the name of it, but to actually be like, no, this is what it's going to sound like. We're going to use this open to show you that Radiolab isn't your run-of-the-mill radio show. This is a complete, like, revolution of the medium.
And Taylor, you were saying earlier when we were talking about this that people didn't, there were a lot of people that actually did not like this.
Yeah. I mean, I think you see this with public radio listeners in general, which is that, you know, some people really appreciate the sort of sound effects and the sound-rich environments and, you know, panning from the left ear to the right ear if you're listening on headphones. And then there are other people who that stuff is just, like, too much. They just want to hear, you know, like a standard theme and a host introduce the show, and they want to get right into it. So I did hear that it was pretty divisive at first.
People are confused by it.
Yeah. Well, they don't quite know what they're listening to. But I think at this point, you know, now Radiolab is this institution that's been doing this for so long that, yeah, it's more than just an open. It's like an icon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Molly Donahue is also with us. She's one of our producers. And Molly, you were talking earlier about when we were sort of discussing opens that we liked. You talked a little bit about Serial, which is also a little bit groundbreaking.
Well, and Serial is so iconic now. Like, they, every time they do a parody of it, you know exactly what is going to happen the minute you hear that plink, plink, plink.
This is a Global CalLink prepaid call from
Adnan Sayed,
an inmate at
Taylor, do you have a favorite?
It's hard to pick just one. I would say one of my favorite, but I think it's sort of underappreciated theme songs, is the music that they play at the beginning of On the Media. And I think partially, too, just because I love the way the horns come in. I mean, it's a good song, but it's not like, a lot of theme songs are pretty cheesy. And, you know, no offense to like ATC or Morning Edition, but they've got that like newsy sound. And On the Media is just hip, jazzy.
And it sounds like New York where it's produced. Can I also add another one that I like?
Yeah, of course.
You know, I see this other trend that's happening for podcast opens, especially from the Nerdist Network, and that's Chris Hardwick has a bunch of shows that come out of Nerdist out west, and they kind of do tongue-in-cheek, almost throwback 80s style opens. And so one of my favorites is You Made It Weird. It's a show that's hosted by Pete Holmes, and the musician Reggie Watts did the open, so we can kind of hear it.
You made it weird.
But that's something that's kind of breaks all of the rules that you think, like, oh, if you want to be a cool show. So yeah, they're kind of, you know, showing that the show is going to be funny, hip, by doing this kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know, throwback to an 80s sitcom or something.
Thank you, Taylor, Maureen, and Molly, for sharing your favorite opens, and we would like to hear from you. What is your favorite radio or podcast open? Did we miss any? I'm sure we did. Let us know on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter at wordofmouth. Thanks for your listening time today. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott, and she will be back in the host's chair tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.